Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. U.S. home prices have been soaring in cities across the country. The Des Moines metro area and other cities in Iowa, no exception to that. Perhaps you've been involved in the housing market, either as a buyer or a seller. If so, you've certainly noticed these are interesting times in real estate. Joining us this half hour to explain what's going on, Tracy Turner, Associate Professor of Finance at the Ivy College of Business at Iowa State University. Professor Turner, Tracy, welcome to the program.
Yes, hi. Thank you for having me.
I understand your primary areas of research are residential housing markets, home ownership, and looking at how housing markets behave. But that's perfect for what we're doing this half hour. We want to invite our listeners to join us with any questions about the current real estate market, perhaps an experience one of our listeners has had. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. As I said, Tracy, you focus on how housing markets behave. How would you characterize the behavior of this current market?
Well, I would say the market was strong before the pandemic began, and it was really strong in most places across the country, including in cities in Iowa. And I would say that pre-pandemic, there was already this sort of interest, households moving to upgraded housing or larger housing in rings further out from the urban core. So households already moving to the core had really kind of begun prior to COVID. But we also had low interest rates, lots of refinancing activity. And so we had pretty strong house growth and demand for housing prior to the pandemic. And then, of course, the pandemic added additional demand shocks to local markets. So with the pandemic, right, we've had people working from home, high income, middle and higher income households who tend to own their housing, able to work from home, focused on their housing, and unable to travel. So lots of cash on hand. So I would say there's definitely a household level surge, some pent up perhaps demand for housing that really got noticed during COVID when households were working from home. So we had a strong market pre-pandemic, and then the conditions during the pandemic, combined with low interest rates, combined with some other factors on the supply side, including kind of low inventories in most places around the country, helped to fuel house prices.
Can you give us some relevant data, what you just explained, from here in Iowa in percentages or what other units you use, just so we know the magnitude of this strong demand in real estate for housing and the shortages of inventory?
Yes, I can. And I also, so I grabbed Des Moines to have a look at the Des Moines metropolitan area. So this includes West Des Moines and multiple counties. And I also had a look in comparison at some other neighboring larger cities like Des Moines. So the Kansas City metro area and then the Minneapolis metro area for comparison. And what I'd like to say is that, first of all, what we tend to see in the Midwest, in cities like the ones we have in Iowa, is that there's an ability to expand the housing stock when demand increases. So when households are looking to trade up, when households are looking for larger homes with more amenities, when there's population and job growth, right? That's the central driver that we observe in housing markets would be population and job growth. And combined then with potentially more cash on hand brings about this kind of surge or even sometimes frenzy for trading up and buying new homes. You know, renters moving into homeownership, current homeowners, say, trading up or doing reno. So let me say that what happens typically in the kinds of markets where the housing stock can readily expand is we see it expand. So we might have a bit of a steep run up in price, but then development increases. It's a signal, right, that higher price to developers to bring new product online. And so then we see prices stabilize and maybe kind of go a little bit flat for a while once that new stock is brought online. But there's lots of cities outside of the Midwest and outside of really in the coastal areas and mountainous regions of the U.S. where you can't readily expand the housing stock. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to emphasize that housing markets are really local, and they depend both on the ability geographically to expand, but also on regulatory restrictiveness. So to the extent that it's a sort of building-friendly environment without a lot of hurdles and with readiness access to permits, you can see new housing come online, and that's what we tend to see in cities like, say, Des Moines, Kansas City, Minneapolis. So let me preface my remarks with that. Now, mm-hmm. for data, what I'd like to share with you is what we tend to see during good times, strong economy, is maybe a 4% per year increase in house prices. So this is for residential housing, and this is for homes that are considered. So I'm looking at specific data from the Federal Housing Finance Agency, and they produce publicly available data that's based on conventional loans. So housing that's financed with a conventional loan, and that's most houses out there. So let me preface my remarks with that as well. And then looking at the data, what we see for Des Moines is that there was pretty strong growth. So 4% is a good number per year on average for residential housing to be increasing in cities like Des Moines. Sometimes we're more like at 2%, maybe 2 to 3%. Now, this can be different depending on the neighborhood. I'm talking about the overall average for the metro area. So let me say that in 2018, it was close to a 4% increase in house prices in 2018. So that's strong. 2019, on average, in the Des Moines metro area, we see that house prices went up by 3%. And in 2020, by another 3%. So taken as a whole, we see 18, 19, 20, the combined effect is that house prices are about 10% higher on average in the metro area. And let me emphasize, this measure that I'm citing is actually using multiple observations on the same property, either through repeat sales or refinances. So to get a little technical on you, I'm confident in this measure that it's not just reflecting expensive new construction. It's actually measuring property-specific increases in value. So this is a go-to measure that researchers tend to use because of that. It's a great measure. And so what can we say? We can say yes. Yes, house prices have risen. They're strong, and they've gone up in the Des Moines area by about 10% in the last 3 years. Was there an especially strong year during COVID, as we might have thought, with households competing for limited housing stock mm-hmm. because of COVID circumstances? Not especially. It was a 3% on average increase across the metro.
One factor that you haven't mentioned that I'd like you to comment on, Tracy, is the lumber prices skyrocketing. This has a big factor for new home construction, of course. What's the story behind that?
Yes, great question. So this is going to affect inventory and the price of new construction. Absolutely. And what's happened there is there were some serious supply chain issues for processing of lumber during COVID. So there was lumber, but it was not manufactured lumber needed to build new homes and new, commercial real estate opportunities. So we see this both for commercial real estate and for residential real estate, enormous increase in lumber prices. So a statistic I've seen recently is that the recent increase in the cost of lumber has added about $35,000 to the average home wow. price, new home yeah. price.
That's amazing. Just in the lumber. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have new homes being constructed, trying to meet this demand. So when we look at this environment right now, the winners and losers in the current situation, of course, if you have a home or you have multiple homes, you've seen them appreciate in value tremendously over the last year. But the losers, I guess, one would be people in the market for a first-time buyer of homes. They've perhaps been outpriced from the market, haven't they?
Yes, yes. And I think we'll know the extent to that in the coming months as we see more data. And let me also mention, Ben, that I'm looking at the, when we look at 2021, we're gonna see the stronger price going up because of the lumber issue. So that lumber issue has really kicked in on inflating house prices, I would say, in the last 6 months. So the data I cited for you were just through the fall of 2020. Mm-hmm. So I think we are going to see that. I know that we've seen a surge in housing starts, and so that's going to, you know, this demand is fueling new construction. We'll see in the coming months when the new data comes out how much it's pushing prices up in the local Des Moines area.
Right. Is this, you've been focusing with your comments on urban areas, the Des Moines metro area to be specifically, is this a different story in more rural parts of the country, parts of our state?
That's a great question. I could take a quick peek at the data to answer that. I don't have those numbers
okay,
handy.
Okay, if you don't have the data handy, that's fine. We'll move on from there.
But may I say, I will say one thing. Where we see the strong demand surge and multiple bidders on a given home, you know, those are households that were able to accumulate cash during COVID. So we might think of workers able to work from home who couldn't travel or take the family vacation. And we did see quite a large increase in savings rates nationally. So that's going to tend to be in areas where you have more job sort of skilled workers located. So I'm going to make a prediction that we're not going to see as strong of an effect in more rural areas where you didn't see kind of a pent-up demand from workers who are working from home.
Mm-hmm. Minorities. How has the current housing market impacted racial minorities and other underrepresented groups?
So I would say that two things. First, for all households, when this process occurs, you have a kind of heated market. As prices are rising and you need money for down payment, you need financing, you know, any household that doesn't have adequate savings is going to be pushed out of the market. So I would say it really comes down to, I would focus on, do households have savings for the down payment? And then do households have sort of a history or experience with homeownership? So to your question, we know from historical factors, there are various reasons why, but what we know is that minority groups have substantially lower homeownership rates in the U.S., and I think that creates an impediment. So if you didn't grow up in a family that owned, there could be an impediment for you. You don't have that learning or support factor from parents that own their housing to be able to purchase your own housing. Mm-hmm. So there's that factor, and they're substantially lower. So, for example, for black households, the homeownership rate has been around 50%. I'll have to check the recent, but I'd say about 52% of black adult households own their home, whereas for white adult households, that number is closer to 80%. Mm. So there's a very big disparity in homeownership rates. Now, that I would say that's exacerbated by a situation where you have really heated markets.
Yeah. Right.
To answer your question.
Right. Let's just remind our listeners who may have just joined us. Tracy Turner with me, Associate Professor of Finance at the Ivy College of Business at Iowa State University. She researches residential housing markets, home ownership. So we're getting a snapshot from her of what's going on with the housing market. If you've been involved with it as a buyer or a seller, you certainly know it's an interesting market.
Seller's market.
It's a seller's market for sure. I have just to share some just anecdotal evidence. I live in the Iowa City Coralville area, but and I have for 20 years. But a neighbor was commenting to me the other day, sold his house the first day it was on the market at asking price. Another neighbor sold the house. There were just a lot of people interested on the very first day and took $10,000 above the asking price for it. So that shows you what, when people are coming in, charging in and saying, I'll give you $10,000 more than you're asking for it.
Yeah, exactly.
What has this done to the rental housing market?
So you mean the surge in demand for
right,
upgrade
are there,
on housing?
Right, when there's a shortage of housing to buy, does that put pressure on rental housing or perhaps, you know, rental housing in COVID times, now that we're hopefully emerging for good from the pandemic? Any general comments there?
So what I would say, at a given point in time, you have a group of renters and a group of owners in a location. And if there's population growth and that new population can't filter into owning as easily, then that population growth is going to put pressure on rental markets, and we're going to see strong rents or rising rents.
Mm-hmm. What about commercial real estate? How does that fit into this picture?
You mean in terms of COVID effects?
Right. What is the state of commercial real estate? We've seen, you know, we had in residential more people working from home, more people planning to stay working from home, and I guess less office space needed, right?
Yes, and we see that in the numbers. So in 2020, pretty steep decline in returns on office, very, very large vacancies erupting in office space. Rents are coming down on office space. So I recently saw some numbers for Des Moines, you know, there's some estimates. I talked with an industry colleague the other day, and there's some estimates that, it could take 10 years to absorb the excess office supply space. Hard to know how if that's going to take 10 years, but there's an enormous amount of vacated office space. To date, we just have a couple large firms, headquartered firms, that have announced the return of employees fully or partially. So there's the possibility that if more firms, headquartered firms, bring back full-time their people, say by the fall, you know, that could create ancillary businesses that start to fill out some of that vacated office space. But office took the biggest hit. Well, retail, I would say retail and office. For commercial real estate, for investors, returns, they experienced a decrease in returns in 2020, and there's still high vacancy rates. That's what I would say.
Is there anything you can do in that position? With vacancy rates, do you have a plan B when you have a lot of commercial real estate that's vacant, or you just leave it vacant for better times?
I think there's maybe two things to think about it. One is it could be converted. So those investors or owners, landlords, could look to convert that office space into even apartments, depending on the level of reno or conversion, or into other types of, say, retail space. So there could be conversion. In Des Moines, it turns out that a lot of the office space, because of the headquartered companies, is company-owned. And so those vacancy numbers, you know, for those firms, those vacancy numbers are in part reflecting corporations that own that space and use it themselves. So what we might see over time is the extent to which they do bring back workers or not, you know, whether they start to shed some of that office space or add some, depending on how, you know, the economy goes and where we move from here.
Mm-hmm. In the last 3 or 4 minutes of our conversation, Tracy, let's look forward. The first question there, this is a boom, a strong seller's market in real estate. Will it be followed by a housing bust? Does that necessarily happen, one follow the other?
No, it doesn't necessarily happen. We saw that in 2006, and that was a complicated story about credit ratings and, you know, subprime mortgages. So what we saw in 2006, which brought down 2007, 2008, that kind of a crisis where we had a really big boom in housing across the country and mm-hmm. in cities countrywide, that was also part of a financial crisis that really brought down the economy. Our experience right now with this COVID situation is very different, in my opinion, because we really had a sort of delay of economic activity with the possibility of sort of a so-called V-shaped recovery. So I would say that we need not worry about an impending bust. Certain urban areas are experiencing people vacating, and that's still going on, people moving out of the cities, both because they can now potentially continue to work remotely, but also because of, so when you can work remote, that's very attractive if you otherwise have a two-hour commute. Yep. So let me comment on that. But for the rest of the country, and certainly in the Midwest, my prediction is that, you know, we'll see a surge in price until the pipeline kind of clears out a bit and we get more inventory, more built, and lumber prices come back down. They will settle, right? This is just a short-term shortage of lumber.
Are we talking a year or two before this sort of pipeline gets cleared?
I would say a year. Within about a year, we'll probably see house prices kind of settle more around the 2-3% in our local area. Mm-hmm. You know, about the rate of inflation is the typical. But we should see this sort of frenzy of multiple bidders on one property. You know, that should be slowing down, I would predict, in the next 6 months.
Mm-hmm. In the final minute of our conversation, share some of the big questions or the things that you're watching pertaining to the future as we go forward in these next few months in the housing market. What are you most curious about?
I'm very curious how firms will organize, how they're going to manage the coming 6 to 12 months in terms of bringing workers back. When workers get back to work, they're less interested in expanding their housing or buying larger housing to suit a home office. So I think that there's a lot of dynamic that's going to happen if workers do come back en masse. Some people argue that we may not see that ever again. I kind of think we're going to move back towards to a pre-COVID worker type arrangement for companies. And when that happens, we're going to see our more urban spaces in Des Moines, you know, more revitalized with businesses, restaurants being more present, coming back.
Tracy Turner, fascinating area that you study. Thank you for sharing some of your research and thoughts. Associate Professor of Finance at the Ivy College of Business at Iowa State University. Thank you, Tracy.
Thank you. It's been delightful.
Coming up after a short break, as Ragbri approaches, we learn about the very first long-distance biking excursions in our state way back in the 1800s, if you can believe that. Also, an update on vaping, as that industry is struggling to survive amid an avalanche of lawsuits. That's when we return. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment.
Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
Can we heal the environment? In Kansas, we're working on it. Up From Dust is a podcast about how humans reshaped the world to fit urban landscapes and agricultural needs. We'll meet the people who are rolling up their sleeves to find more sustainable ways forward. Listen to Up From Dust from KCUR, part of the NPR network.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Ragbri, the Register's annual Great Bike Ride Across Iowa, set to kick off later this month. So it's a good time, we thought, to delve into Iowa's early biking history. And I don't mean the origin story of Ragbri from the early 1970s. Of course, biking in the state goes back much farther than that. Let's listen back to a conversation I had in 2020 with Leo Landis, state curator of the State Historical Society of Iowa. Here's how that conversation started. I wanted to start off by having you describe a photo, which our listeners can access by going to iowapublicradio.org. It's a photo that you provided us from 1886. I'll read the caption, then I'd like you to tell us about it. The caption reads, "Bicyclists on State House Steps, Des Moines, Iowa, August 14th, 1886. Bicyclists rode from Des Moines to Spirit Lake, Iowa." Would you describe this photo? It's so remarkable. You don't even believe these are bikes.
Yeah, those are the early bicycles. It's actually the second generation. The first style that most Iowans had were a style that looked somewhat similar to today's bicycles, at least in scale. But the bicycles in that 1886 photo, it's a group of League of American Wheelmen from Iowa, and they're getting ready, as the caption says, to ride to Spirit Lake. They're the high wheel style. And the advantage to the high wheel style of bicycle was you moved a little faster. It absorbed a little bit more of a shock on those hard rims that they were riding on with a solid rubber tire. That's the pre-inner tube tire days. So it's a solid rubber tire on a metal rim. And so having those big wheels, A, it gave you more speed, and so you could cover more distance. And it also cushioned the blow of the ride on the Iowa roads and any roads. And then the other advantage or challenge, I guess, in this case would be is, you know, getting that running start that they typically would use. There'd be a little pin on the back wheel or on the frame that you'd rest one foot and you'd kick start and get a running start, and then you'd swing your leg up and on. So
yeah,
I've never mastered that.
Well, if I passed one in on Rag Bri in 2016, in fact, it's on my I've tweeted it out. And so if you'd like to see that, it's remarkable because this back wheel, and we can all picture them just to remind ourselves, that this back wheel is perhaps shoulder height of the rider, and the front wheel is as big as maybe a beach ball or something like that. But Leo, what's remarkable is when we talk about Des Moines to Spirit Lake, this ride that these 1886 riders were on, that is about 200 miles. And that on a modern bike is no small feat. And they did it on these vastly more difficult to power bikes.
And yeah, it's a single speed, really. I mean, it's there's no gears for adjusting on those hills as you get into the Raccoon River Valley. And that was really the route they took. And I need to chat with one of my colleagues, and that's probably a photo taken on August 9th. That was the day they left. They arrived in Spirit Lake on the 14th. And for Central Iowa cyclists or folks that have cycled in Central Iowa, they followed the Raccoon River Trail a little bit. And mm-hmm. so they went from Des Moines to Waukee to Adel on the first day, and then some other towns, Redfield to Jefferson on the second day, Cherdan to Fonda on August 11th, then Newell to Storm Lake. And they did take, I think on either the 11th or 12th, they rode a rail car for just a little bit, Ben. So they got a little bit of a reprieve. So maybe sagged a bit, as cyclists would say. And,
yeah.
And then on the 13th, they rode from Sioux Rapids to Spencer, or Storm Lake, Sioux Rapids to Spencer. And then that last day, they rode from Spencer to Arnold's Park on West Lake Okoboji and finished at Spirit Lake.
Mm-hmm. And with those tires, those hard rubber tires, unforgiving tires, if your butt's on the seat for sure, and there's a bumpy road, those roads would have, I wouldn't have thought the roads would have been in good enough shape to ride that far.
The farmers wanted to have good transportation too, and this is a conversation we've had with Charity Nebbe on Talk of Iowa, but farmers were grading their roads typically. They wanted to be able to get to town every now and then. And so there were township road crews operated by local farmers. And that was one of the things bicyclists as well had become champions of, was improving roads. And so we know from just various accounts, but there was a bicyclist out of Bonaparte, John Entler, that we may have a chance to talk about. He was a member of the League of American Wheelmen, and they really did promote better roads, both for bicyclists, but also then we're saying, hey, this is a benefit to farmers.
Mm-hmm. tell us a little bit about the culture we imagine at that time, because of course these days we grow up with bicycling, and there are bicyclists of all types and bicycle clubs of all types. It was a fairly new device, contraption probably would be a good word for it at that time. How was it thought of?
Yeah, especially in those high wheel bicycles, those would cost about $100 per bicycle. And so it was really something that generally in Iowa, wealthy people participated in, and wealthy males, or at least, you know, prosperous males who then developed an interest in bicycling. You could say there's, you know, maybe a little bit of an analogy, but today with safety bicycles and the multi-geared bicycles, just about anybody who knows how to ride a bike can jump on. But in that period from really 1860s is when velocipedes start coming into Iowa. Then into the early 1890s, when the safety bicycle, that's similar to today's bicycle, it really is a recreational activity for wealthy males. But it was something that was enjoyed by men in small to mid-sized towns, as well as people in larger cities. And you know, farm families probably regarded it as frivolous. So not a lot of farm families were purchasing those high wheel bicycles. It wasn't until the 1890s and the safety bicycle comes in.
Mm-hmm. And the safety bicycle, you mean it looks, has the design more or less of our bicycles today.
Exactly right. And the other thing that happens with that, you know, kind of standard frame that we're accustomed to today is, as we said, you start getting the Dunlop patents in Great Britain and the U.S., the tire with an inner tube. And so you're no longer riding on a solid rubber tire in the 1890s. You do get a tire with an inner tube in the 1890s. So that really cushions the ride a lot, too.
Mm-hmm. Did people use them for more than sort of leisure activities, sort of bike commuting? Did that come into practice in the 20th century or earlier?
You know, as a commuting device, most people lived near where they worked in the 19th and early 20th century in small and even a lot of times mid-sized towns. And so walking was a lot more common, too. Mm-hmm. And you would see, you know, for some occasional business or it really was recreational, sometimes business. There's an account, again, down in Bonaparte. John Entler owned a hardware store in Bonaparte, and our Iowa City office, Mary Bennett, has been a great caretaker of the John Entler scrapbooks that we have. And he has a clipping in his scrapbook from 1896 that does say that Mr. A.L. Hallman, the gentlemanly miller of Bentonsport, made a cycle business trip to Bonaparte last Monday. So we know it did happen on occasion.
Okay. And when you're talking about these longer bike rides, you know, Des Moines to Spirit Lake, you know, we could talk about sag wagons. They couldn't have packed really anything on it like you see on some ragbri bikes. So they did have sag wagons, but these would have been, what, horse-drawn sag wagons? How do they manage?
Yeah. I think when I said they sagged, you really did have rail lines that if you needed to get, you know, for some reason, somebody's bike, you know, they couldn't repair it on, and they weren't real complex, but if you had a problem that you couldn't repair on the road, because of local and short line routes on rail routes, you usually could catch a train if you were, you know, in Chardin, you could get to Lorville or Fonda by train without too much difficulty. And that's, you know, we have such great benefits with the rails to trails programs that happened in the 1990s to today, that's part of that network that, you know, benefits us. And so if they were riding a road that was near a railroad, they could get to a depot and catch a train, I'm sure, on those longer rides.
Leo, before we go, I really have to have you talk a little bit about something you brought up before we started this interview, that bike riding has at least a small chapter in women's emancipation, at least according to Susan B. Anthony.
Yeah, there was a reaction against women riding bicycles. And in fact, Iowa newspapers in 1896 carried a notice from a group called the Women's Defense League that talked about bicycling leading to, reckless women and engaging in immoral and suggestions and imprudent associations. So later in 1896, Susan B. Anthony was asked by the noted journalist Nellie Bly what Susan B. Anthony thought about bicycling. And she said, "Let me tell you what I think of bicycling. I think it has done more to emancipate women than anything else in the world. I stand and rejoice every time I see a woman ride by on a wheel. It gives woman a feeling of freedom and self-reliance. It makes her feel as if she were independent. The moment she takes her seat, she knows she can't get into harm unless she gets off her bicycle. And away she goes, the picture of free, untrammeled womanhood." And of course, this is a time when women didn't have the vote. And so Susan B. Anthony did. She saw it as liberating activity.
Wow. Beautiful words from Susan B. Anthony. Thank you for sharing that and for sharing your thoughts and your research into early biking in Iowa. Leo Landis, State Curator at the State Historical Society of Iowa. Leo, always good to talk with you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Ben.
And finally today on this edition of River to River, remember not too many years ago when vaping entered the picture? E-cigarettes, they simulate tobacco smoking, but instead of smoke, the user inhales vapor, hence the name vaping. Well, now sales of vaping products have plunged by $500 million. The workforce has been cut by 3/4. Operations in 14 countries have been abandoned, and many state and local lobbying campaigns have been shut down. And what of Juul Labs, the once famous e-cigarette company? It became a public health villain to many over its role in teenage vaping. Seems to be, shall we say, now gasping for survival, trying to persuade the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, to allow it to continue to sell its products here in the U.S. This from the New York Times. The FDA is trying to meet a September 9th deadline to decide whether Juul's devices and nicotine pods have enough public health benefit as a safer alternative for smokers to stay on the market, despite their popularity with young people who never smoked but became addicted to nicotine after using Juul products. Now, some major health organizations, including the American Heart Association, American Lung Association, American Academy of Pediatrics, and American Cancer Society's Cancer Action Network, have asked the agency, the FDA, to reject Juul's application. Last week, you probably heard this in the news, the company agreed to pay $40 million to settle just one lawsuit. Juul having to cough up $40 million in North Carolina, one out of thousands of complaints, lawsuits against it. Let's get one perspective on vaping in Iowa from Anais Adam, health promotion specialist and tobacco prevention coordinator with Siouxland District Health. Anais, welcome to the program.
Hi, welcome. Thank you for having me.
We have a few minutes. I understand you do a lot of education outreach in vaping and tobacco use. Give us a sense of vaping in your area. Also, how much of a problem it is, continues to be.
Yeah, so, I mean, vaping overall is seen more of a youth activity. More teens vape overall than adults, older adults, or even young adults. In fact, according to the 2020 FDA National Youth Survey, about 19.6% of high schoolers and 4.7% of middle schools currently use e-cigarettes. Compared to adult use from the CDC in 2018, only about 3.2% reported current e-cigarette use. So we see a higher percentage of high schoolers and middle schoolers using e-cigarettes here in Woodbury County. According to the Iowa Youth Survey, which was last conducted in 2018, I believe it's done every 2 years, but because of COVID, it wasn't done in 2020. But 2018, 6% of sixth graders, 11% of eighth graders, and 24% of 11th graders were currently using e-cigarettes. Wow. So overall, in the state of Iowa, only about 2% of 6th graders, 8% of 8th graders, and then 22% of 11th graders were using e-cigarettes. Woodbury County, the county I work with, is a little bit higher than the state average, unfortunately.
Yeah, and this, for those who don't know, vaping answered some kids' dreams of being able to smoke in school, so to speak. You're vaping in class, even, to get a buzz without from nicotine without teachers even noticing, because they got rid of sort of the puffs of vapor mist that you saw in some of the early vaping devices. So it's still going on. What can you tell us about the health consequences, Anais?
So according to the CDC, 90% of e-cigarettes contain nicotine, which we know is addictive. And then, you know, for teenagers, young adults who don't use regular combustible cigarettes, that can create an addiction to nicotine and then lead to the use of regular cigarettes. But it's not just the nicotine in e-cigarettes that you need to be worried about. It's also all of the dangerous chemicals in the vape juice that is being inhaled into the body. There are over 60 chemicals in the vape juice, including formaldehyde, which is used as a preservative. Cadmium is found in car batteries, acetone, nail polish removers. And this all harms your body if ingested. It can cause lung injuries and lung issues. And the problem is that we don't know what the health consequences of it will be in the future. With these lung injuries that we're seeing with vaping, we don't know if people are going to be able to recover from that because they're being caused by chemicals in the vape juice.
Right. And just think of that the substances that you mentioned, cadmium and so forth, formaldehyde being atomized, being turned into really small particles so that they reach the innermost parts of your lungs. You don't have to think too long to know that cannot be good for you. What are the remedies in your work, the effective, most effective strategies to bring these numbers down, especially young people vaping?
Education is the biggest thing, I think. You know, going into the high schools and talking to these kids, middle school, high school age kids who are, you know, just starting to either start vaping or they know people that vape, just so that they have that information, I think is the place where we need to, you know, start and keep doing more of that. Just because a lot of the time, most of these kids just don't know all of the facts. They think that they're only just vaping water or flavoring, but water cannot be vaped. The chemicals inside the vape juice, the vape pods, they're not just water or flavoring. There are a ton of these other different chemicals that are extremely dangerous. And a lot of people just don't realize that. So I think education is huge, and it's a big, big part of that.
Mm-hmm. Do you believe, Anais, that state laws, Iowa state laws, are adequate?
Well, I mean, the legal age in all laws, or sorry, in all state to buy vaping products is 21, which is great. Are they adequate? I'm not really sure compared to, you know, what the...
I mean, perhaps you don't, in your work, you don't think about this, but I guess I'm asking, are there perhaps things, regulations, policies that would be helpful that aren't in place now?
So, like with the settlement with Juul that happened, Juul cannot use anyone in its marketing materials who is younger than 35 years old to pay for influencers to promote their products. So regulations like that, I think, need to be put more in place. I think the reason for the youth epidemic in regards to e-cigarette smoking is because of all of this social media advertising that they are doing with social media influencers. So things like that, can they be really regulated? I don't know. Should they be regulated? Probably, because a lot of teens and young adults are on social media and following these influencers and, you know, influencers who promote these products can get a huge group of people to also buy these products and use these products. And it just changes the way we see things.
Right, right. And we really have just a minute or less than a minute, but tell me, what is your sense? Do you get a sense of if parents are always aware of vaping? It's much easier to hide. You can hide it from a teacher. I imagine it's being hidden from parents all over.
It's extremely easy to hide. A lot of the times, some of these vaping devices look like, you know, highlighters. They look like USBs. They look like everyday school supplies. So parents should definitely keep a lookout on that aspect. It's like I said, it's very easy to hide. And, you know, these companies are smart enough to make these products that way.
Anais Adam, Health Promotion Specialist and Tobacco Prevention Coordinator with Siouxland District Health. Thank you for giving us an update on vaping in Iowa. Thank you for your work to encourage, sounds like young people mostly, to kick the habit, vaping and tobacco. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Can we heal the environment? In Kansas, we're working on it. Up From Dust is a podcast about how humans reshaped the world to fit urban landscapes and agricultural needs. We'll meet the people who are rolling up their sleeves to find more sustainable ways forward. Listen to Up From Dust from KCUR, part of the NPR network.
River to River, produced by Matt Alvarez, Rick Brewer, and Zachary Oren Smith. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on the program, 6 months after the deadly insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, at least six Iowans continue to fight criminal charges for their alleged role in that riot. I'll talk tomorrow with IPR's Kate Payne, also the AP's Ryan Foley, on the aftermath of last weekend's fatal Adventureland accident. We'll talk about it tomorrow. Hope you'll tune in then. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.